content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled America Built an Actually Good Airport by Ian Bogost, a technology article from the February 2023 issue. In 2004, Steven Spielberg made an entire movie about the terror of getting stuck for months in an airport. But I might be happy never to leave the new LaGuardia. Air travel itself, the part where you are crammed like a rodent into a metal tube, is clearly miserable. So is everything in its orbit. The barfsome cab ride from the city, the shameful indignity of security, the sullen panic of being away from home, and, most of all, the ghastly purgatory of the airport that detains you. For a very long time, New York City's LaGuardia Airport felt like the intricately dressed set of an apocalypse film. Spread across its terminals were abandoned check-in stands gone feral, floors damp with discharged moistures, low ceilings looming over dark corridors. Now, near the end of a 9-year, $8 billion rebuild of its main terminals and roadways, LaGuardia has become an unexpected hero for American infrastructural renewal. It is an incredible airport. Terminal B, which houses most airlines, feels like a theme park, in a good way. Delta's Terminal C, still under construction, has its cramped and dingy concourses replaced with airy new spaces and a swank, cavernous airline club. Across the airport, sedans and taxis breeze through drop-offs and pickups unencumbered. The aircraft taxiway flow now, too, is making arrivals and departures more efficient. Slowly, word is getting out. People return from the Big Apple and talk about their trip to its airport instead of its restaurants or museums or theaters. I went to LaGuardia to find out how this unlikely victory was wrest away from the claws of long-term neglect, and what its example can teach a nation with decrepit and outmoded infrastructure. Many of America's roads, bridges, airports, and other facilities to keep people and the economy in motion were erected in the 1960s, two generations ago. In the time since then, the U.S. population has nearly doubled, yet efforts to address the nation's growing needs have fallen flat. Even 2021's giant infrastructure bill invested only a fraction of what many civil engineering experts say the nation needs. Our country once took pride in building things, but then all the things got built. To take pride in rebuilding them will require new approaches to design. When I paid a visit to the renovated airport in East Elmhurst, Queens, I found that it has a message for America. The future of infrastructure is here, and it's fun, and it's expensive, and it's built right on top of its forebears. Frank Skremen, an extremely tall, impossibly friendly mechanical engineer turned airport management CEO, rushed me up an escalator. I'd just traversed the largest TSA checkpoint I've ever seen in a matter of minutes. It was an unusual experience in that it did not create in me feelings of existential despair. A curtain of windows dumped natural light across my path as I tried to get my bearings. The escalator spilled us directly onto a floor of shops and then out into a courtyard where patterned streams of water were surging from the ceiling into a fountain below. Projectors set up above cast images of the Statue of Liberty, the Chrysler Building, and other New York landmarks across the runnels, synchronized to music. This was the show, a Vegas-style water feature, and the passengers nearby stood rapt. An airport isn't generally a place where one stops moving. That's even more the case in New York City, the world's most impatient place. But in the center of the rebuilt LaGuardia, I watched mesmerized as travelers parked their rollerboards abruptly, just so they could watch the stalks of water raining down. The shows change seasonally, giving even frequent flyers a reason to pause. Airlines and their passengers have conflicting goals. An airline wants to get passengers to the gates and onto the planes on time. Passengers want to avoid the boredom and discomfort that comes with spending time in airport seats. The only available distractions, walking, looking, shopping, eating, and entertainment, come at the cost of anxiety around departure. Terminal B attempts to address this problem in its physical design. A central check-in and security space leads to this commercial zone, which then branches out to two concourses of gates, each accessed via a glass skybridge that rises over the taxiways, planes passing underneath. Large, continuously updated signage shows the travelers the timing of their flights. Human agents flank these signs, ready to answer questions and give advice. In the U.S., we're very much a go-to-the-gate culture, said Scrimmon, who led this terminal's redevelopment. By encouraging people to occupy the commercial district that radiates out from the fountain for as long as possible, Scrimmon explains, the airport discourages them from crowding together too early at the gates. It also brings in revenue for Scrimmon's company through retail leases. Both goals are best accomplished, it turns out, by filling the airport with gratifying, almost meaningful activity. Scrimmon sees his role as being more like a hotelier's than a property manager's. Lighting dims and cools as the day turns to evening. The staff are dressed in black, hotel-style uniforms, and even the restrooms have attendants, and shelves and entryways wide enough that you don't bump suitcases with other passengers. The terminal is a place you want to be rather than one you wish you could would just spit you out again. This is LaGuardia's first lesson for rebuilders. Infrastructure can't just serve a functional purpose, not anymore. It has to offer an experience. LaGuardia, which opened in 1939, was long overdue for some improvement. By the 60s and the heyday of the jet age, the airport had already outgrown it. Half a century later, the airport felt more punishment than port. The terminals, far too small and pressed too close together, created a bottleneck for runway traffic that added to delays. Funnels rooted roof leaks into trash cans scattered around the terminals. On the streets outside, cars clogged departure lanes and taxi stand queues overflowed. In 2014, then Vice President Joe Biden inveighed against the place. If I took you and blindfolded you and took you to LaGuardia Airport in New York, you must think, I must be in some world, third world country, he said at an event in Philadelphia. The Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which is responsible for the facility, had been talking about redevelopment for years, but Biden's comment was a catalyst. Until then, Port Authority Executive Director Rick Cotton told me, redevelopment at LaGuardia had been done piecemeal. A new garage here, a renovated road there. But this time the agency developed a master plan to develop the whole airport, its two main terminals, and the entire roadway network. As if rebuilding an airport isn't challenging enough, Cotton said, the commitment was to keep it operating during the construction. LaGuardia was serving about 28 million passengers a year at the time on more than 350,000 flights. All of those people and flights were meant to continue as before, except the old airport would slowly vanish as a new one took its place. The charge, both crack-brained and essential, reveals LaGuardia's second lesson. Rebuilding infrastructure means erecting new on top of old. A roadway or a power plant or an airport that nobody needs and isn't used doesn't have to be fixed up. Infrastructure gets rebuilt because it's still important, and that's what makes rebuilding it hard. To solve this problem, the Port Authority collaborated with Terminal B's LaGuardia Gateway Partners and Delta Airlines, which operates Terminal C, on a design that would allow them to construct the new airport terminals over the old ones, as in physically above them. The constraint to keep the airport fully operational got baked into the new design. At Terminal B, the dramatic sky bridges that ferry passengers from the commercial center to the concourses were put there not for drama, but to allow the builders to keep the old airport operating beneath the bridges while the new one was constructed. In the terminal, Ryan Marzullo, Delta's managing director of New York Construction and Design, showed me the traces of such decision-making in the completed structure, including angled steel pylons and passageways that had to be overbuilt with structural trusses to accommodate the old roads, where taxi and passenger car traffic flowed underneath. Suspending the bridge temporarily, he said, cost at least $8 million. Marzullo had many other stories of costly construction carried out just to make way for more, even costlier construction. These are design and engineering feats, but also testaments to will, collaboration, and the acceptance of a budgetary reality that hasn't been commonplace for a century. Sometimes you just have to spend money, a lot of money, to get something done. Rick Cotton admits that wouldn't have happened without Port Authority's private partners. LaGuardia's failure so far to extend subway service to its door shows just how difficult fitting the pieces together is. But the lack of public transit is to some extent a function of what was there before. That's what happens when you're building new on top of old. The refurbished airport is more efficient than it's ever been, but the ghosts of its deficiencies linger. The new LaGuardia aspires to not just be any airport, but New York City's airport. The fountain show in Terminal B offers placeness. So do local business outlet shops, installations by local artists, and expansive views of the Manhattan skyline. Indeed, it was the lack of this quality, or at least an embarrassing mismatch of place, that inspired the first version of the airport back in the 1930s. After landing at Newark, the only commercial option at the time, Mayor Fiorio LaGuardia complained that his ticket said New York, but he landed in New Jersey. Shame and pride are two sides of the same coin. Twice now, the dishonor of New York City's airports has helped catalyze their future. So here's the third and final lesson for reinvigorating the nation's infrastructure. Americans pretend that reason drives big changes, but passion always takes the wheel. Even Cotton of the Port Authority seems to think that's true. When I asked him what other municipalities might learn from LaGuardia, he first listed off some platitudes about ambition and capability, a commitment to overcome obstacles and go through walls. But then he acknowledged another deeper motivation, the dismal situation to which we had fallen. Perhaps the inspiration for renewal can benefit from or even require an awakening humiliation. LaGuardia's reconstruction was, in some sense, a response to Biden's insult, but also to the disgraceful state of the airport, which now has been transformed into a swanky theme park. Rebuilding wasn't easy, but the challenge of deciding to rebuild came first. Perhaps the pride of rebuilding is less important than the shame of having failed to do so. If this nation's civil engineering has now become a joke, and Infrastructure Week is just a punchline, that could mean America is on the right track. Our second article is entitled, No One Really Knows How Much COVID is Silently Spreading Again, by Catherine J. Wu. This is from the February Health section. In the early days of the pandemic, one of the scariest and most surprising features of the SARS-CoV-2 was itself, stealth, initially assumed to transmit only from people who were actively sick, as its predecessor did. The coronavirus turned out to be a silent spreader, also spewing from the airways of people who were feeling just fine. After months of insisting that the symptomatic had to mask, test, and isolate, officials scrambled to retool their guidance. Singing, talking, laughing, even breathing in tight quarters were abruptly categorized as threats. 3 years later, the coronavirus is still silently spreading, but the fear of its covertness again seems gone. Enthusiasm for masking and testing has plummeted. Isolation recommendations have been pared down and soon may disappear entirely. We're just not communicating about asymptomatic transmission anymore, says Saskia Popescu, an infectious disease epidemiologist and infection prevention expert at George Mason University. People think, what's the point? I feel fine. Although the concern over asymptomatic spread has dissipated, the threat itself has not. And even as our worries over the virus continue to shrink and be shunted aside, the virus is continuing to change, which means that our best ideas for stopping its spread aren't just getting forgotten, they're going obsolete. When COVID-2 was new to the world and hardly anyone had immunity, symptomless spread probably accounted for most of the virus's spread, at least 50% or so, says Megan Fitzpatrick, an infectious disease transmission modeler at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. People wouldn't start feeling sick until 4, 5, or 6 days on average after being infected. In the interim, the virus would be xeroxing itself at high speed in their airway, reaching potentially infectious levels a day or two before symptoms started. Silently infected people weren't sneezing and coughing, the symptoms that propel the virus more forcefully outward, increasing transmission efficiency. But at a time when the tests were still scarce and slow to deliver results, not knowing they had the virus made them dangerous all the same. Precautionary tests were still scarce or very slow to deliver results, so symptomless transmission became a norm, as did super-spreading events. Now, though tests are more abundant, pre-symptomatic spread is better known danger, and repeated rounds of vaccination and infection have left behind layers of immunity. That protection in particular has slashed the severity and duration of acute symptoms, lowering the risk that people will end up in hospitals or morgues. It may be even chipping away at long COVID. At the same time, though, the addition of immunity has made the dynamics of symptomless transmission much more complex. On an individual basis, at least, silent spread could be happening less often than it did before. One possible reason is that symptoms are now igniting sooner in people's bodies, just 3 or so days on average after infection, a shift that roughly coincided with the rise of the first Omicron variant and could be a quirk of the virus itself. Faster arriving sickness are probably being driven in part by speedier immune responses primed by past exposures. That means that the illness might now coincide with or even precede the peak of contagiousness, shortening the average period in which people spread the virus before they feel sick. In that very one specific sense, COVID could be a touch more flu-like. Coupled with other population-level immunity, this arrangement could be working in our favor. People might be less likely to pass the virus unwittingly to others, and thanks to the defenses we've collectively built up, the pathogen itself is also having more trouble exiting infected bodies and infiltrating new ones. That's almost certainly part of the reason that this winter hasn't been quite as bad as past ones. That said, a lot of people are still undoubtedly catching the coronavirus from people who aren't feeling sick. Infection per infection, the risk of super-spreading events might now be lower, but at the same time, people have gotten chiller about socializing without masks and testing before gathering in groups, a behavioral change that's bound to counteract at least some of the forward shift in symptoms. Pre-symptomatic spread might be less likely nowadays, but it's nowhere near gone. Multiply a small amount of pre-symptomatic spread by a large number of cases, and that can still seed another large number of cases. There could be some newcomers to the pool of silent spreaders, too, those who are now transmitting the virus without ever developing symptoms at all. With people's defenses higher than they were even a year and a half ago, infections might have once been severe are now moderate to more mild. Ones that might have been mild are now unnoticeable. Better studies on transmission patterns would help cut through the muck. They're just not really happening anymore. To get this data, you need to have pretty good testing for surveillance purposes, and that basically has stopped, says Yonatan Grad, an infectious disease epidemiologist at Harvard School of Public Health. Meanwhile, people are just straight-up testing less and rarely reporting any of the results they get at home. For many months now, even some people who are testing have been seeing strings of negative results days into bona fide cases of COVID, sometimes a week or more past when their symptoms start. That's troubling on two counts. First, some legit COVID cases are probably getting missed and keeping people from assessing test-dependent treatments such as Paxlovid. Second, the disparity muddles the start and end of isolation. Per CDC guidelines, people who don't test positive until a few days into their illness should still count the first day of their symptoms as day zero of isolation. But if symptoms might sometimes outpace contagiousness, I think this positive test should restart the isolation clock, Popescu told me, or risk releasing people back into society too. American testing guidelines, however, haven't undergone a major overhaul in more than a year. Right after Omicron blew across the nation, says Jessica Malati-Riviera, an infectious disease epidemiologist at Boston Children's Hospital, and even if the rules were to undergo a revamp, they wouldn't necessarily guarantee more or better testing, which requires access and will. Testing programs have been winding down for many months. Free diagnostics are again growing scarce. Through all of this, scientists and non-scientists alike are still wrestling with how to define silent infection in the first place. What counts as symptomless depends not on biology, but behavior and our vigilance. As worries over transmission continue to falter and fade, even mild infections may be mistaken for quiet ones, Grad told me, brushed off as allergies or stress. Biologically, the virus and the disease may not need to become that much more muted to spread with ease. Forgetting about silent spread may grease the wheels all on its own. Next is an edited article from the March 2023 How to Build a Life section, entitled How to Find Joy in Your Sisyphean Existence by Arthur C. Brooks. Sisyphus, the king of Ephraim, was renowned in Greek mythology for his ingenuity. Indeed, so clever was he that he cheated death twice, angering the gods. They took their revenge by condemning Sisyphus to eternal torment in the underworld. He had to roll a huge boulder up a hill. When he reached the top, the stone would roll back down to the bottom, and he would have to start all over, on and on forever. Nowadays, any task combining boredom, struggle, stress, and futility might be labeled Sisyphean. Think of the so-called duct tapers in customer service who are tasked with angry people all day while the conditions that create those aggressive customers never change. One could even argue that all of life is Sisyphean. We eat just to get hungry again and shower just to get dirty again, day after day until the end. Absurd, isn't it? Albert Camus, the philosopher and father of a whole school of thought called absurdism, thought so. In his 1942 book, The Myth of Sisyphus, Camus singles out Sisyphus as an icon of the absurd, noting that his scorn of the gods, his hatred of death, and his passion for life won him that unspeakable penalty in which the whole being is exerted, toward accomplishing nothing. With his absurdist views, you would think Camus would endorse such a perspective of the natural awfulness of life. But he doesn't. Quite the contrary. In The Myth of Sisyphus, he acknowledges the futility of Sisyphus's task and its obvious parallels in our ordinary lives. But he argues that despite the hardships of this world, against all apparent odds, human beings regularly experience true happiness. People in terrible circumstances bask in love for one another. They enjoy simple diversions. Even Sisyphus was happy, according to Camus, because the struggle itself toward the heights is enough to fill a man's heart. Simply put, he had something to keep him busy. This conclusion led Camus to a strategy for a life that is utterly at odds with most philosophers of the past two centuries. Instead of feeling desperation at the futility of life, Camus tells us to embrace its ridiculousness. It's the only way to arrive at happiness, the most absurd emotion of all under these circumstances. We shouldn't try to find some cosmic meaning to our relentless routines, getting, spending, eating, working, pushing our own little boulders up our own little hills, he says. Instead, we should laugh uproariously at the fact that there is no meaning and be happy anyway. Happiness for Camus is an existential declaration of independence. Instead of advising, don't worry, be happy, he offers a rebellious, tell the universe to go suck eggs, be happy. If you have an inexplicable moment of happiness in a difficult world, don't overthink it. We should be able to do better than relying on serendipity for occasional happiness. In fact, each of us can consciously implement Camus' absurdism in order to forge a happier life. Here are three practical ways to find joy in the ridiculous. 1. Stand up to your apathy. When you feel existential dissatisfaction, that sense that everything is meaningless, giving up can feel like the easiest course of action. But this is where Camus' call to rebel should really kick in. You can't necessarily change your perception of the world, but you most certainly can change your response to that perception. Meet that feeling of despair with a personal motto such as, I don't know what everything means, but I do know I am alive right now, and I will not squander this moment. Say it out loud so you can comprehend it fully and consciously. 2. Look for opportunities to do a little good. One of the best ways to cultivate futility is by focusing on the big things you can't control, war, natural disasters, hatred, as opposed to the little things you can. Those little things include bringing a small blessing or source of relief to others. For example, if your commute to work is a soul-sucking nightmare, don't ruminate on the cars stopped ahead of you. Rather, focus on making space for that poor sap stuck in the wrong lane who's desperately trying to merge. If you're sitting at your desk wondering whether anyone would notice if you stopped during your job, bring the colleague in the next cubicle a fresh cup of coffee and enjoy the small delight that small kindness brings both of you. 3. Be fully present. Absurdity tends to sting only when we see it from the outside. For example, when you think about how meaningless it has been to wash the dishes every day in the past, only to find them dirty again right now. And imagine the countless dishwashings that the rest of your life will comprise. Confronting the absurd is much more comfortable when you do it with mindfulness. This is the point that Vietnamese Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh made when he wrote, "Washing the dishes, one should only be washing the dishes," which means that while washing the dishes, one should be completely aware of the fact that one is washing the dishes. When the broad sweep of life brings you horror, concentrate on this moment and savor it. The pleasure and meaning you find right now are real. The meaninglessness of the future is not. You may not agree with Camus' core assumptions about the world. I, for one, believe that life is not meaningless and that there is a cosmic purpose to my work and yours, that love and life will transcend this mortal coil. I believe that we have a divine nature that endows my existence and yours with transcendental meaning. But on my bad days, well, I doubt all that. Some mornings I wake up seeing only the boulders I can't face pushing them again and can't face pushing them again up that hill. Those are the days when my old friend Camus comes in handy. Instead of despairing at the absurdity of life, I lean into it, laugh at it, and start my day in a light mood. Then I gather my beloved boulders and set out for the nearest hill. That is all the time that we have for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.